It's a Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. According to the American Alliance of Museums, there are approximately 850 million visits each year to American museums, more than the attendance for all major league sporting events and theme parks combined. However, in a recent opinion piece for the Tribune Review, our pop culture contributor Joe Woes wonders whether we're seeing the death of the art museum. Well, we've asked Joe to join us, along with two people who might disagree. Joining us in Studio A are director of the Frick Art Museum, Robin Nicholson.
Hi.
Hi, Robin. And president of the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh, Joellen Parker.
Glad to be here.
And, of course, Joe Woes. Hey, Joe.
Good to be back.
Welcome, all of you, to Essential Pittsburgh. We'd like to have our listeners weigh in. Are you still going to museums? If not, why not? What's keeping you or what is keeping you going to museums or keeping you away? 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. Is going to museums still a priority in your life? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Joe Woes, you say in your op-ed, art might not be dead, but it is on life support. How so? Explain your thinking here.
Well, and I also mentioned that the kids want to unplug it to plug in their cell phones. You know, and I think that's very true. I think we see a generation that views the world through the lens of their phones. They go to concerts. They watch them through the phone. They sit right next door to their friend and text them. And I think that generation, as hard as it is to fathom, just don't care that there's a difference, that they don't need that real-world experience. They feel they have the connection they need, and the quality of it to them is the same. For us, you know, we can't imagine a world where we don't go and view the work of art, that seeing on a monitor would never capture that. To this generation, they can zoom in with such detail, they've seen the work of art in their minds.
But they're not seeing it with their naked eye.
No, they're not. They're seeing it on a screen.
And so, for lack of a better way of putting it, is that just messed up?
It can be. It also can be a generational gap that we see things one way, they're going to see it in a different way. And I think we're starting to see that change.
But you're also saying that that art museums and their struggle for cultural relevancy are making themselves irrelevant. How so?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of, I think I say this, there's sort of like that, you know, that creepy old guy at the nightclub trying to wear the hip clothes and listen to the modern music. And in doing so, they're sort of trying too hard and putting people off. As you try and embrace this new technology, there's no way to keep up. You know, the technology in a child's bedroom is higher than the technology in a museum. They can sit there playing a Wii U at home and go to a museum, and it's not the same sort of vibrant, interactive, they're in control of the art form experience. Video games have put kids in charge of the storylines and in charge of, in their world, the art. They're curating their Facebooks.
And no, these are all interesting insights, and I wanted at the outset to make this conversation, you know, more about the relevancy of art museums and less of a sociological discussion, but as I listen to you describe these things, and there's no reason to question any of the insights you're conveying, they all seem to be spot on. What do you think about and I'll have our guests who are art museum directors, but chime in on this. But what do you think about the role of parents in all of this? Should they maybe say, you know what, you hear these PSAs on the radio from time to time about unplugging and going off into nature. If we go off into an art museum, is it incumbent upon the parents or the mentors or whoever is guiding young people to say, unplug, put these things down when you go in here and view this art the way it was meant to be viewed, the way the people that created these works of art intended for you to see them?
Yes, but part of the problem is the last time I was at the Carnegie Museum of Art, which was only about a month or so ago, I actually saw a teacher who was going through the field trip and turned to one of the kids who was acting up and said, if you don't pay attention, you're not going to get to go see the dinosaurs. Art shouldn't be a punishment.
And that would have got my attention.
And it did get their attention.
What? No dinosaurs? I mean,
but how long can an art museum rely on the dinosaurs bringing kids in and keeping their interest? The art kind of loses their interest quickly because they can't swipe through it.
Let's go first to Jo Ellen Parker here. What is the impact of technology on museums?
It's enormous. As the impact of technology is enormous on every information and communication-based industry. Newspapers, libraries, museums, radio, television are all being impacted by technology. What we have to do as museums, I think, is figure out how to make the impact of technology on the museum itself as a technology for the display and teaching about art. So we need to adapt as the technological environment around us adapts. And we need to keep up with that audience that Joe describes. Make it a both-and experience rather than an either-or experience as young people become more digitally sophisticated.
Robin Nicholson, what about the impact of technology on museums?
Well, that impact is profound, but I think the key issue here, and that's where I think Joe Ellen and I profoundly disagree with Joe, is that there is, in a world where anything is available through technology at the touch of a fingertip, there is a strong craving for authenticity. And that is something that an art museum delivers, which no other cultural phenomenon can deliver. And that is why, even if audiences decline, even if perceptions change, the ultimate relevance of the art museum will never disappear.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation. Let's go to Dan in Squirrel Hill. Dan, welcome. You're on with Robin Nicholson, Jo Ellen Parker.
Never miss it.
Oh, wait, say that again. I was talking over you.
I said I hardly ever miss your show. It's very informative.
That's what we like to hear.
Keep up the good job.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead with your comment or question.
I'm a big advocate of museums. In fact, I have a membership at the Carnegie Museum that allows me, when my wife and I are traveling, to go to museums in almost any city in the country at no cost. And I just learn a lot at museums. And I think that, really, I'm an advocate. And I take my kids when I'm out of town. We go to different museums, whether it's children's museums, art museums, science museums. Particularly, you're going for the first time, I really encourage people to get a docent, and you can learn so much more.
Dan, can I ask you how old you are?
I'm over 65.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. So you get it, but you are a product of a generation that was raised to view art in the traditional way. Now, as far as your children, what was it like for you raising them? I'm assuming that a lot of this technology was available when they were younger, when you were first starting to take them to museums. So how did you approach that particular excursion?
Well, no, my kids are a little bit older. I mean, I have grandkids. My oldest grandkids will be 10 years old.
Okay, so do you take them to museums?
Yeah, particularly children's museums, because they're just fascinating. And there's so many things that, you know, you can see there and learn.
So, Joe, what about what Dan is saying here?
Yes, and the distinction is children's museums. Children's museums are active experiences where you're directly engaged. It's not just observational. You're participating. Children's museums are doing really well. As I mentioned, dinosaur museums are doing really well. If you actually look at sort of those hands-on museums and dinosaurs, you know, it sells. The Museum of Natural History and the Smithsonian got 7.5 million visitors last year. That is more than all of the Smithsonian's art museums combined. So if you're providing what interests them, a children's museum, a hands-on experience, they'll show up. They'll pay. I think they're losing interest in art. They love children's museums. They love science centers.
Piece, Joe says, to his point, in their struggle for cultural relevancy, art museums are making themselves irrelevant. I'm guessing that our guests, Robin Nicholson, Jo Ellen Parker, might disagree. What about that statement?
Well, to speak to Joe's point about the hands-on experience, I mean, one of the buzz phrases that's going around in the museum world at the moment is the participatory museum. And that's something that art museums are directly engaging with. We realize that art is something that is created by human hands. So what is a more engaging experience than understanding the creation of human hands, very different from dinosaurs or things you see in a children's museum. And so the goal of the art museum is to work out how do we engage the people with the understanding of the creation of art. It's a two-way process. It's not preaching. That's the key issue with art museums today. We are trying to engage our audience in an authentic experience.
And how are you doing that? Are you tapping into technology or what?
In a number of ways. The question about relevance is a question about something being relevant to a particular audience for a particular purpose. So, for example, I was in our galleries the other day. I saw a group of young school children standing by the Walking Man statue, and their teacher had charged them with imitating its posture and talking about how it made them feel to assume the posture of the Walking Man. And in that moment, the Walking Man became relevant to that class for that purpose. In another experiment that we're beginning to develop, we might well make a 3D printer image of the Walking Man so that visually impaired visitors could handle it and touch it and get a sense of its dimensions and shape that would be very relevant to them in that moment. So to me, the question of relevance comes back to the question of being audience-centric, knowing who's coming to your museum for what purpose, and responding to them in the moment with a docent, with a technology, with an experience, with an educational program, with a Wi-Fi image that they can use to compare what they're seeing with things that are being held in other museums around the world.
Let's go to Mary in Edgewood, who would like to join the conversation at 412-246-2002. Mary, welcome to the show. How are you?
Fine. Thank you for taking my call. I had a comment about something Joe said a little bit earlier, and he was talking about the technology that's available to children and how interactive it is, and it's hard for museums to keep up with that. And as someone who works in education and technology, I feel that we overestimate the interactivity and what students are doing sometimes when they're using things like educational software. It can be a pretty passive experience as compared with maybe creating your own software or games. So, for instance, one of our students one time created an online dinosaur museum because he was interested in dinosaurs, and so that was a pretty creative act. But I think the challenge is really the same for both people in bricks and mortar museums and people designing technology or working with kids in technology, and it's to make it an experience that they are doing the active, they are getting to do the active work and exploration.
It's an interesting comment, Mary, and you bring up a good point, and I would ask Robin and Joellen, have we gotten to the point where, and Joe kind of describe that scenario of, you know, when I guess the Gen Xers, maybe it would be, were growing up, that you'd go to a museum on a school tour and it was be quiet, form a single line, don't touch the art, don't run around, don't do this, don't do that. Have we gotten to the point where we simply can't expect in this day and age with all of the things that children are exposed to now, to have them just stand there and silently observe the art and move from exhibit to exhibit and just listen to the docent or the tour guide or whoever it happens to be taking them through?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say that that's absolutely the way we have to go. We have to allow visitors to essentially curate their own experience in the museum, not wait to listen to what the received interpretation is, but to have that personalized, unique, authentic experience that, again, they couldn't get anywhere else. But we have to be open to that communication. The phrase museum 2.0 has been used. It's a two-way conversation that we have to have. Technology helps us do that. It doesn't fulfill the entire function of everything. But ultimately, that gives us the tools to engage in a much more dynamic conversation than ever happened in art museums before.
Do you, however, by taking that approach, do you run the risk of, by increasing the engagement of having the observer miss out on the expertise that could be shared because they may not be involved in simply the listening of the experience, of just paying attention to what somebody with insight has to share.
In this day and age, we know that expertise comes from our fellow visitors. It comes from crowdsourcing as well as coming from curators and scholars. One of the things that I think is very important is that people come to museums not just to look at the art themselves, but to interact with other people who are looking at and thinking about art. And I think we need a broader definition of expertise. The wisdom of a curator, published scholarship that you can access in the galleries, the perceptions of a second grader who's looking at a piece of art for the first time, those are all different forms of expertise that our museums provide a venue for people to share.
So you're not particularly worried those who, like yourselves, who are in charge of overseeing the museum experience, you're not necessarily concerned with the idea that we could run the risk of dumbing it down.
No, I think that is never going to happen because, again, I think we have the infrastructure to create the strength, in a sense, of the collection of the intellectual components. But ultimately, we are opening the doors in a much more profound way to that feedback from every voice that we can hear and bring that to the table and really create some very profound experiences. And that's really the mission, the goal, the vision of the art museum of the future. It's an exciting time to be running an art museum.
We're talking about the relevancy of art museums in today's technological age and our conversation ignited by an op-ed written by our culture contributor, Joe Woese, wondering whether we're seeing the death of the art museum. His piece appeared in the Tribune Review. He is here along with two other guests who may strongly disagree or take an opposite tack from his opinion, the directors of the Frick Art Museum, Robin Nicholson, and the president of the Carnegie Museum of Pittsburgh, Joe Ellen Parker, Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh. Let's go to Ken in Bethel Park at 412-246-2002, who wanted to join the conversation. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I'd like to go back just for a minute to the premises for the discussion. And Joe Woese early on gave a nice summary of the conventional wisdom about digital natives, about how they watch concerts through their phones, they text their next-door neighbors, and so forth. And Paul, you said, well, Joe, there's no reason to question those insights, but I think there are loads of reasons to question those statements.
Well, let me clarify that, Ken. Well, I guess what I was not – I'm not questioning the validity necessarily of what Joe is saying, but I mean, there's no doubt that when people go to concerts, or museums, they're looking through their phones. They are looking at other media rather than necessarily focusing on the thing. Like for example, at a concert, you wonder today with the giant video screens and the devices that people have, whether they're actually how much they're actually paying attention to the actual person on stage that you came to see. And I'm supposing that works the same way in an art museum. Are we really looking at the thing that is in front of us, the actual materials, the way that the canvas bubbles out in certain points, that kind of thing?
Right. Well, I agree with you that there's no disputing the phenomena that more people use electronic devices than ever. But I don't think that applies exclusively to younger generations, whether you call them millennials or digital natives or whatever. And I would commend to your attention an article that was in the Washington Post earlier this week. The headline is, let me scroll up here again, it's Why Digital Natives Prefer Reading in Print. Yes, you read that right. And I think I do training, workplace training, and although, sort of the Reader's Digest version of Generations in the Workplace or the Newsweek version or the BuzzFeed version is, well, younger people use technology and older people don't. And I think if you scratch the surface and go a little bit deeper, you'll find that that's just not true. There are plenty of older people who use technology, and there are plenty of younger people who love to interact with whether it's a musical performance or theater or artwork, just as much. I think we all have access to the tools, and I think it's a mistake to use a broad brush and say, well, young people, you know, kids today just don't appreciate real art. I think it's up to the adults, and Joellen used a great example of the teacher who helped her students interact in a creative and fun way with the Giacometti, that, you know, if we show people that it's not just about lining up and filing past silently and observing, it's interacting with the art, then it's just as rich for young people as it is for folks of my generation. And just listening to Joellen and Robin's comments, I have great faith that museums will continue to survive and thrive into the 21st century. And don't forget that a lot of contemporary art also uses electronic media and is extremely interactive. So with that, I'll hang up. Say thanks for taking my call. Have a great day.
Thank you, Ken. And maybe we're redefining art. Is that part of it? Joellen?
Certainly redefining the museum. Certainly redefining the museum as a place for the display of discussion about interaction with meditation on art.
You do say, though, in your – you wrote a rebuttal piece to what Joe wrote, also in the Tribune Review. And there's one line that jumped out at me toward the end of your piece where you say, all this is not to say that the introduction of new technologies is not disruptive to museums. So in what ways are they disruptive?
They're enormously disruptive. They are disruptive, as I mentioned in the piece you refer to business models. They are disruptive to the professional training of docents, curators, preservators. They're disruptive to our systems of tracking metadata and preserving art. They're disruptive to our styles of communication. So there are many, many ways that they are disruptive, but it's a creative disruption. And to me, as I say in the piece, the question is how we will evolve our practices as museums to take the best of what these technologies bring us, manage the disruptions in a mission-centric way, and continue to engage audiences as we have done for the last century.
Robin, do you – I guess one of the things that might concern people, and it's something that I wonder about myself, and that is, does the technology get in the way of the visceral experience of the way we experience art in the ways that it moves us?
It does. And I think it's a mistake to see technology as monolithic because, I mean, a lot of museums jumped on a bandwagon early on by creating apps, by creating interactives, which ultimately proved to be dead ends. They did not enhance the experience. And so I think we have to treat technology in the way that it's evolving and not saying there is a technology that will help us interpret art, but how do we look at art through different viewpoints? And I think that's where technology gives us an amazing panoply of opportunity, which we're only beginning to scratch the surface of. Again, I think it's not that technology is getting in the way of the museum experience. It's just opening up new vistas for getting at the art in much more interesting and profound ways. And undoubtedly, what Joe says is the ability to visit a museum online virtually across the world is incredible. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing that just didn't exist 10 years ago. And so in a way, that is not a barrier, but that is just an entry point into the museum world.
By the way, what are the rules? So many people have phones and they go places and they want to understandably take pictures of what they see. What are the rules in your museums, in the Frick, in the Carnegie, about taking photographs?
Well, we actually literally a couple of weeks ago, we changed the rules to allow photography in the art museum, which previously was not allowed. So we have changed that policy.
So somebody can come in with their iPhone and take as pictures of everything they see?
Absolutely.
And for you, Joellen?
It varies somewhat in our different galleries and in our different museums. I got to tell you, in the lobby of the Warhol, the number of selfies that are taken on that Warhol reproduction sofa under that piece of art is staggering. So certainly in some places and some galleries we can allow photography. In other places we have to have more restrictive rules.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Lorraine in Squirrel Hill. Hi, Lorraine. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Well, I guess I spoke too soon. If Lorraine is not there, we'll go to Anne. Hello.
Hi.
Is this Anne?
Hi. Yes. I'm an artist in Pittsburgh, and I also teach art. I've got several comments on what's been said recently. I just want to make one little comment to go on to my main point. I find it very disruptive going into a museum and having people stand in front of artwork that I want to look at and take photographs and obscure my view from enjoying and looking at the work. So I think that's really problematic, and I hope that museums are thinking about that. And my experience of just being able to stand there and see the work without it being obstructed.
Well, let me bring Robin into this. And as this is a relatively new rule change that you've made about people being allowed to take photographs in the Frick, and I'm sure this is as this evolves, you'll make adjustments. But Anne brings up a point. Do you have to step in and kind of referee what is going on because people might be kind of blocking other folks' view of the art?
Well, ultimately, this has been a huge debate in the art museum world. And in many ways, the cultural change has forced our hands. There is no way that you can stop people taking photographs in an art museum with everybody having a smartphone. So in a sense, we have to be as accommodating as possible, but also try to make it a positive experience. And so it's going to be a question of training the custodians, training our docents, training people to understand how people use photographs and really encourage people to use photographs in creative ways, to share them with friends, to curate their own tours, to do all sorts of imaginative things with photographs. But it is a challenge, undoubtedly.
And are you still there?
Yeah.
You wanted to make a point about that there's a place for just looking at the work and having discussions.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted to say is that a good docent is going to interact and get people to interact with the art. It's not just standing there and listening to somebody talk at you. But I do want to say, as an educator, an art educator, I've had some really astounding responses to art and art making and art looking by students who really don't know much about art.
Where are you teaching, Anne? Anne, where are you teaching?
Well, right now I'm teaching at the Art Institute, but I ran a program for a few years connecting youth to their local trails through art. And one thing that happened that I'll never forget is a middle school student who I was in the bathroom washing brushes. We'd been doing a project in her classroom painting, and she was in there helping me, and I said, "What are your favorite subjects?" And she said, "Math and art." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "I like math because I'm good at it, and I like art because it takes my anger away."
Great point, Anne. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I was blown away by that.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. We need to wrap up here. Final thoughts from each of you. Joe, going forward, to your points.
You know, they just had Museum Selfie Day, you know, where people came in and used art as backdrops to selfies. And I think that's the risk you run. Yes, you need to embrace the technology, but you don't want to devalue the experience completely. I think you hang on to what you have, you fight the good fight, and then if you have to, go gently into that good night. Don't devalue what you're doing.
About what Joe's saying, Robin?
I love Museum Selfie Day. I think that is an amazing opportunity for an individual to engage with an individual work of art that they might never look at in the same detail again. So I think it's great. I love it.
Joellen, we'll give you the last word.
I don't think technology threatens the extinction of our museums. I think it will support their evolution.
Joellen Parker is president of the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh, and we've also been joined today by Robin Nicholson, director of the Frick Art Museum, and our culture contributor, Joe Woese. Thank you all for engaging in a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation with Ali Najad, host of HLN's new show, The Social Life, on what he found in Pittsburgh. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's billed as a travel show with a twist. Debuting this week on Headline News, better known as HLN, is the program The Social Life, hosted by travel junkie, foodie, and sports fan Ali Najad. He visits cities based on recommendations from his Twitter followers. First stop, Pittsburgh. He's with us now by phone. Ali Najad, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Ours is the first city featured on your debut episode. How did you decide on Pittsburgh?
I'll tell you what. Pittsburgh was a city that I had never been to before, and that's not the only city that I had not traveled to before for the show, but it was one where I really had some preconceived notions on what I was going to encounter and was so pleasantly surprised that that contrast was really appealing as far as making it our lead episode.
We gave a brief description of the show in the introduction. Tell us a little more about yourself and how this show developed.
Well, I myself have been working in television as an on-air host for about 20 years now, believe it or not. I started in my teen years, and it was right around when Twitter first came out that I was doing a podcast that was called Poker Road Radio, Surrounded Poker, and the guy who had hired me on to do it was aware of Twitter and said that we need to become early adopters, we need to get on top of this. And it was begrudgingly that I created a Twitter account, and who could have predicted how wildly popular the platform would end up becoming and how instrumental it would be into me being able to create The Social Life, which was essentially an opportunity to utilize social media for good and to connect with folks. The premise of the show essentially is to mine my Twitter feed and any other social media platform, be it Facebook or Instagram, to get suggestions on what cities to travel to, and then either prior to arriving or even while in that city shooting, make an effort to connect with people and get suggestions on where to go, and then identify in each one of those cities somebody who I felt was deserving of some sort of gesture, some sort of acknowledgement, some sort of appreciation for being a positive contributor to that community and a good person. And in Pittsburgh, I came across a gentleman by the name of Tom Colas, who was just operating a double-decker tour bus. He was my tour guide and made such an incredible impression upon me in the short time that I had with him, that I knew instantly he was the guy that I wanted to do something for. Just a hardworking, honest, kid. And I say kid, but he's in his early 30s, but just a childlike enthusiasm. And I think that that's very representative of Pittsburgh in general, is really hardworking, honest people who are there. They're in it. They're committed. They're not folks who are looking to get out or who are begrudgingly in Pittsburgh. They have a love for the city and a passion, and I think it was really refreshing and felt very privileged to have crossed his path and even more privileged to have been able to set him up with sort of a dream come true situation in our episode.
So who is this show for? I mean, what is your target audience here?
You know, I would love to tell you that it's narrowed into one specific target audience. I feel like it's broad. It's broad because, let's face it, there is a generation out there who wasn't raised using social media. That's myself included. I'm in my late 30s now, and people my age and a little bit older can remember a time where we didn't have Facebook, and we had to pick up a phone and call someone, and there wasn't texting, and there wasn't Twitter, and there wasn't Instagram and Snapchat and all these apps. I mean, it's a little bit overwhelming for folks, I think. And this is a really simple way to integrate and to give people an opportunity to utilize some of these mediums that maybe they're not completely entrenched in to connect with me and to make an impact and suggest that I come out somewhere and realize that, hey, I will absolutely meet you somewhere and sit down and have a meal, and I want to hear your story, and I want to connect with you. And then on the other side of it, Paul, you've got the kids who are at the forefront, people in their teens, people in their 20s, who are the most vociferous users of social media. And it's an opportunity for them also to say, hey, rather than continue to exercise the vanity elements of this and to experience the sort of one-directional consumption that is the highlight reel effect where you start to feel inadequate, you look at, your Facebook feed and you go, why isn't my life like that? But it's not reality, right? And people are always trying to represent and overrepresent their existences, particularly in that demographic, I think, and say, hey, like, it doesn't have to be a tool to make me feel isolated. It can be a tool to make me feel connected, and not simply through my cell phone screen, but actually in the real world with a complete stranger. And I am a huge advocate of taking advantage of things like Hinge and Tinder, which are set up as dating apps ostensibly, but are great ways when you're traveling to connect with a complete stranger and to sort of feel like a member of a global community. And when you travel, as I'm sure you know, Paul, you really gain perspective and insight, and you really come back home with a renewed sense of enthusiasm and an appreciation for life, I think. And I really want for people to be able to take advantage of social media to experience that effect, the warmth, the connection with folks.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Ali Najad, host of the HLN program, The Social Life, debuting this week, and the first episode highlighting Pittsburgh. Ali, what did you know about Pittsburgh? You mentioned the sort of stereotypical impression you had of the city before you got here, which is not unlike what a lot of people think of Pittsburgh if they've never experienced it. What did you know before you came to the city?
I knew about Three Rivers, the Pirates, the Steelers, and that it was the Steel City. And I expected a much more industrial, downtrodden, I mean, I'd be lying to you if I didn't on some level expect kind of the Youngstown, Ohio effect, right, where, you know, economic downturns had had a major impact and there was, you know, abandoned buildings and things like that. But I was so incredibly impressed with the community and the efforts that they're making, you know, the initiatives on the waterfront to restore that, the way in which buildings have been repurposed. I mean, the lofts that I saw that were gorgeous, that were, you know, previously mills or major industrial complexes, the art. I mean, who would have thought at the Warhol Museum? I had no idea that that was in Pittsburgh. And the mattress factory, which I toured, which was such an incredible hands-on experience. The food. I went to a little restaurant called The Butcher and the Rye, and I mean, it was on par with any new up-and-coming restaurant I would have bumped into in downtown Los Angeles, you know, where I previously lived. I mean, it was really completely out of left field, and I didn't know much about the city. And I'm glad that it kind of set me straight. And the people, what great, great people, Paul, honestly. I mean, just good, hard-working, stand-up, you-can-count-on-them type of folks who have so much love for the Steelers. It's ridiculous. It's so great. But as it should be, right? It's a big city with a small-town feel.
And a lot of people will learn about Pittsburgh through your eyes. It's an interesting program. Is there anything, though, that a Pittsburgher might learn that they didn't know before from watching your show?
Well, you know, I think it seemed to me that a lot of folks that I encountered in Pittsburgh have been in Pittsburgh for a very long time. And maybe they haven't ventured out, or maybe there isn't a sense of awareness of what other people's impressions might be of the city, right? Because when you're inside the bubble, if you haven't gotten out and if you haven't gotten a sense to get exposed to the assumptions that us West Coasters, I'm a native Californian, make about towns like Pittsburgh, you might not otherwise realize just how wrong some of us have it. And it's not because we're not cosmopolitan, and it's not because we don't travel or we don't make an effort to be up on things, but I don't think it's readily understood by a lot of people from outside the city. So granted, I know the angle of the question was more designed for me to get somebody within Pittsburgh to be exposed to a part of the city that maybe they didn't know about, which hopefully things like the Waterfront Restoration Project, which not everybody may be aware of, is something that they can make a contribution to within their own community. But for me, taking it from a different slant, it's just the idea that, you know, a lot of people out there don't really get your city, and they don't really understand what an amazing place it is and what kind of amazing people there are there, and to kind of take it upon themselves to be ambassadors when given the opportunity.
So if you were to tweet about one place to visit in Pittsburgh, which one takes the honor?
Oh, I mean, I know the Warhol Museum is a big draw for people, and it wasn't that I don't want to give them a big shout-out, but the Mattress Factory, to be able to go into a place that first off is another example of reclaimed, repurposed space, but also was the hands-on effect. I'm not a museum guy. I don't like walking around, having to keep my voice low, and then pretentiously making some comment about how, you know, this cubist effect, this era was so overrated or something. I don't know. But getting out and seeing, like, you know, getting out and seeing real art being done right now by very contemporary artists that's super hands-on and you can actually walk into and explore, it reignited that childlike curiosity that I think is inside of all of us that at some point we tend to lose or put away. And it was magic. I mean, I highly recommend it. And I am not the museum artsy type of guy, generally speaking. And I had a blast there.
Last question. Did you take enough selfies while you were here?
You know, the selfies that I took, I wanted to make sure that I was taking with people that I had encountered along the way and be tweeting those and referencing those folks' Twitter handles and really demonstrating the the connectivity, right, the thread, the DNA of what this whole show is about, and obviously also the payoff, the opportunity to be altruistic and give back and do good for other people rather than utilize the tool, selfies and posting them online and whatnot, in this self-indulgent, decadent, self-absorbed way that I think can end up happening. You know, the vanity is a little much at times.
Well, I think people will enjoy, Ollie, I think they'll enjoy the way that you connect with people in Pittsburgh and on the show. It comes across as very genuine.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm happy to hear that. People can become a little apathetic when quote-unquote reality TV is anything but these days. And it was really important to me to have the opportunity to be my natural self, to be authentic, and not create the varnish or the layer that I think is commonplace in television these days.
It's The Social Life, a new program debuting on Headline News, better known as HLN, and it's hosted by our guest, Ali Najad. Ali, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Good luck with the show. Thank you for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me, Paul. And stay warm. Get those temps up into the positive, at least. Good God.
We're trying. We're trying. Coming up, more Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Starting today, Girl Scouts of Western Pennsylvania, along with its sister councils across the country, are participating in National Girl Scout Cookie Weekend, a celebration of all of the fun and excitement that these young ladies have selling Girl Scout cookies. Now, I know what you're thinking. Paul, Girl Scout cookies? Seriously? Yeah, but try and convince me that when those tagalongs and those Samoas and shortbread and don't forget the Thin Mints show up on your doorstep or on the counter in your break room at work, that you're able to focus on anything but those cookies. Joining us now for a preview of the event and some of the delicious history behind the cookies is Lisa Shade. She's Public Relations Manager for Girl Scouts of Western Pennsylvania. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in, for bringing cookies. I was able to scarf down a couple of Thin Mints during the break.
Can't resist them.
I couldn't. There's like three boxes of cookies sitting here. What am I supposed to do? So let's get into the history here. And what is fascinating to me is that the Girl Scouts history goes way, way back, over a century, is it?
Yes. Our organization actually is 103 years old. So Girl Scouting has been around for more than a century, helping girls find their confidence, build character and courage, and do lots of exciting things through the Girl Scouting program.
But the cookies came along not right away.
No, not right away, and had some very humble beginnings. The first Girl Scout cookies were actually baked in kitchens and sold by local troops. And I believe that was 97, 98 years ago, though. So there's still the concept is still quite old, but it has come a long way.
You know, basing an economic model on cookies might seem to be overly simplistic, but this is based on just how long it's been around. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. And it gives girls opportunities to build skills at a very young age that they wouldn't have the opportunity to do otherwise. So a lot of people think that, you know, like us, we just can't wait to eat those Thin Mints. But really, when you're buying a box of cookies, sure, you're getting that delicious treat, but you're really giving girls not only amazing opportunities through Girl Scouting, because they use the proceeds to go to camp, to travel, to do community service projects, but you also have just given her a big boost of confidence. And really, every time you say yes to a Girl Scout who's asked you to buy cookies, you are showing her that her goals are possible, that she can do what she sets out to do.
Was there some broader idea at play here about maybe having young ladies, that this was a way of educating them and young people in general about economics and about capitalism and about, you know, you make a product, you know, if you come up with something that is desirable to people, you can market that product. There will be a demand for it, and you'll have a profit, and you'll have to figure out how to manage that profit and where to funnel that money. Does that all play into this?
It's true, and goal setting is part of how Girl Scouts begin their Girl Scout cookie program, and it is a program. So they set their goals. They hone their marketing pitches. There's a lot of preparation that goes into the cookie program before you see those Girl Scouts standing outside your local grocery store. And you're right about the economics of it, because that is really the goal setting and figuring out what they want to do with the proceeds and working backwards from that to find out how many boxes of cookies they need to sell to be able to do the things that they want to do is a great exercise in financial literacy. And there are all kinds of really cool ways that Girl Scouts approach that. There is one troop here in Pittsburgh who actually have done a 2-year business plan for their cookie sales to not only meet their goals in terms of what they want to do for fun. They want to go to camp. They want to do some travel, but also to reinvest some of that money back into the community through their community service projects. So those exercises are extremely important, and they have lasting effects. No university has produced as many female business owners as the Girl Scout Cookie Program. It is really their first taste of business success, and it's happening throughout our community with even our youngest Girl Scouts. So girls in kindergarten and first grade are thinking about, okay, well, what can I accomplish? What do I want to do with this? What do I want to do in Girl Scouting, and how do I get there, and how do I use the Cookie Program to help make that all possible?
Do they have flow charts and projections and all that kind of thing? I mean, they have access to iPads and computers, so why not?
Oh, sure. I mean, each troop certainly takes their own approach to it. And but those five skills, the goal setting, decision making, business ethics, people skills, money management, that is part of every Girl Scouts experience with the Cookie Program.
We're talking with Lisa Shade. She's Public Relations Manager for Girl Scouts of Western Pennsylvania. And yes, if you didn't have it circled on your calendar, this is National Girl Scout Cookie Weekend. It starts today. Now, we were talking in our previous segment, or actually our first segment today, about the relevancy of museums. We were talking about the technological impact and the different ways that people view art now, and they do it digitally. Well, apparently technology has impacted the Girl Scout cookie experience, because there is something called a digital cookie?
There is, and
what is that?
Digital cookie is...
Can you eat it?
Oh, no, but it is another way to access Girl Scout cookies.
Okay.
It is really... digital cookie is a tool for Girl Scouts to access their network in a different way. So through digital cookie, Girl Scouts can build these protected, personalized websites. And from those websites, they can send emails to their friends and family and ask them to purchase cookies through this platform. And it really augments the skills that girls are building. This takes this skill-building program into the 21st century, because you really can't talk about selling products to consumers without talking about e-commerce. And this is really the next step in the cookie program to help girls really hone those 21st century marketing skills.
And I have to ask you before we wrap this up, there are apparently new cookies.
There are.
So the things that I rattled off earlier that we're used to, the Thin Mints, the Samoans, there are new ones on the horizon.
We have two new ones this cookie season. Rah-Rah Raisins are a modern twist on oatmeal raisin cookies. They have Greek yogurt chips in them, and they're delicious. Girls are just raving about them. And then we're also proud to offer a gluten-free cookie this year, which is the Toffee-tastic. And those will all be available at booth sales throughout the community. And if people are interested in finding a booth sale near them, they can visit GirlScoutCookies.org, where they can enter their zip code, or you can download the Cookie Finder app.
It is the National Girl Scout Cookie Weekend. We've been talking about it with Lisa Shade. She's Public Relations Manager for Girl Scouts of Western Pennsylvania. Lisa, I think we all learned something today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. Monday on Essential Pittsburgh, a discussion about privatizing liquor in Pennsylvania. Are we any closer to seeing it happen? That's Monday. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a good weekend.